I'm Jonathan Green, and on Blueprint for Living, this is Lost and Found. And this week, we begin our search for the small gems of the Australian modern. We will be travelling week by week to every state and territory capital. And we begin, why not, in Sydney. Now, the 1950s and 60s, they were a time of great abundance and growth in Australia. And with that came optimism, sort of utopian visions of what Australian society might be. A new iteration of the Australian dream appeared. We're about to journey in search of that to the leafy streets of St. Ives to look at homes that were built by a firm that pioneered architect design project homes. It's the 70s dinner party dream. Later, we'll take a turn around the Reader's Digest building. That should be Fortress in Surry Hills. But first, Hannah Louie and Philip Goad, authors of Australia Modern, Architecture, Landscape and Design, 1925 to 1975. We begin chatting about Sydney Apartments. Sydney Apartments striving for a view, bricks and water. I asked Hannah Louie whether this is a feature of Sydney Modern.
It definitely has the earliest and the most dense expression of apartment living. You know, places like Potts Point and other areas were really transformed. But there's lots of other different experimentations in modern living. I think in Sydney you can chart it across that 50-year time span from some important lessons in early public housing, somewhere like Erskineville Housing of 1937, which we were keen to include in the book. You know, it's not particularly glamorous, but very important model that expresses that social ideals of modernism and housing. But then, you know, lots of other different kinds of models of ways, you know, that showcased ways of living, display home villages like Pettit and Sevett, and into the 60s and 70s, that sort of much more bushy, medium and low-rise density expressions that Sydney does so well.
Are our cities, do you think, Hannah, more disposed to modernist influence? Does this vary from city to city? Is it a different experience in Melbourne to Sydney, for example?
Oh, well, I should think that's a perennial argument between Melbourne and Sydney. I won't get into it. But I think so. Not coming from either of those places. So I'm from Perth, so I have a different sensibility. But I think the way buildings interact with landscape, you know, it just fundamentally changes the Sydney versus that dominant grid in Melbourne in terms of the city. You know, I think when you head out to the suburbs, you might think one is interchangeable with the other. But I was there just not long ago in Sydney thinking about those undulations and the different kind of vegetation just changes our whole perception of the built environment.
It is quite determined by landscape as a city. I mean, that thing too in Sydney, Philip, of the sort of the village nature of the place as it spreads around the harbour.
That's right. It's the whole topography of Sydney, the connection to the water, but those very steep gullies and the capturing of the view in Sydney meant that you have spectacular and often remarkably hidden houses like Hugh Burick's house in Castle Crag. It's an absolute gem and it appears to be built on the side of a cliff almost. And it's those landscape opportunities which really distinguish Sydney and the way, as an architecture culture, they thought about houses in the 60s. And in terms of modernism, Sydney is where they began to really express interest in materials, in not being afraid of getting the terracotta roof back and not being afraid of clinker bricks anymore.
It's interesting too, Hannah, how much, especially in housing, the modernist architects in particular, the 50s and the 60s, respond to environment in that way and see tough sites as a challenge that modernist thinking can work within and can solve.
Yeah, I think you see that very much, and particularly with architects' own houses. You know, see it again in Melbourne, where you have, you know, something like the McIntyre House that's taking on a challenging site, the Featherstone House. They're sloping. They might be near the floodplain, and that gives a chance for experimentation in terms of, structure as well as then a much closer integration with gardens and open plan living.
We can't, of course, leave Sydney without addressing the elephant building in the room, which Hannah is the Opera House.
Yes, and of course we couldn't leave that out of a survey of the greatest hits of Australia. It's an important site in Australia as being nominated for the World Heritage List in 2007, and that's important on world terms of such a young architectural monument.
It's such a wonderful exemplar, Philip, is it not, of how the ideas of modernism interplay with Australia and in all its dimensions. It's a thing which, yes, is given the green light, then encounters all sorts of obstacles, but ends up as being this utter treasure of the entire country.
Yes, the Sydney Opera House is one of those great moments where landscape, particularly in the harbour, is celebrated. Mm. But now the Sydney Opera House is emblematic of the city of Sydney. And even though its whole design ethos is about celebrating the landscape, you can't really understand it without the backdrop of urban Sydney behind it. The very last image in our book has a series of apartments called the Sirius Apartments, which were under heavy threat of demolition. And there, I think, is the dilemma of modernism. So public housing is hard to argue for, but we should be arguing for it. And on the other side of Circular Quay is the Sydney Opera House, which we're at so much great pains to retain and celebrate.
Yes, brutalist public housing with a commanding view of the Opera House, and guess which one they want to knock down.
Correct.
An Australian home among the gum trees. Maybe you think pet it and sev it. Late 60s houses that make the most of natural light. They fit neatly, flatly into their landscape. Adaptable, modular components, early adopters of the ensuite. Exposed timber detailing, you know the vibe. I took a walk in St Ives down Richmond Avenue with Judith O'Callaghan. She's a senior lecturer at the University of New South Wales, an aficionado of the modernist home. And this is where some of the first Pettit and Sevett display homes can still be found. What would this have been like in the mid-60s?
Well, you can imagine it wouldn't have that heavy traffic on Monivale Road, for starters. It was an area that was being developed for new housing, and Pettit and Sevett were among a number of project builders who were out this way. Areas such as Carlingford, Pennant Hills and St Ives were the hunting ground, I guess, for housing development.
And here are some remnant Pettit and Sevett display homes. As a builder, as a developer, what's distinctive about the Pettit and Sevett story?
Well, Pettit and Sevett had only been established in 1961 by Ron Sevett and Brian Pettit, and neither of them were technically builders. They'd had experience in the field through working at Sunline, one of the first project builders in Sydney to offer architect design project housing. Sunline folded towards the end of the 1950s, and then Ron and Brian took on the challenge of building those homes that Sunline had still under contract. So that's how they started in 61. Then very soon after that, they were commissioned, Ken Woolley and Michael Dysart, who were two young architects working at that point in the government architect's office, to design a project house for them, and the first one they built was the split level.
It developed a very distinctive feel.
Yes, they did. They had a very distinctive look, which you can probably appreciate from the houses here, perhaps more so from the courtyard house. Well, next
describe here, not number 15A, we're moving down here to number, beautiful
DNA
number 17.
Yes, that's right. Well, I guess the uniting features of the four houses that were built here in 1964 are obviously the white painted brick veneer on Oregon stud framing and the slate grey concrete tiles and, of course, the stained wood framing to the windows and the doors.
I'm suddenly feeling very Canberra looking at this.
Yeah. Are you indeed?
I am.
Yes. Well, they were incredibly influential. This look became the look of the 60s, if you like, and it spawned many copyists as well as many other project building enterprises that employed architects to design their ranges.
Moving down so we can have a bit of a look, there's a double garage attached on.
And did you say that courtyard by the front door?
The courtyard, yeah. Well, that was the distinguishing feature of the courtyard, as it was called, and one of the bedrooms and the living areas actually open out onto that courtyard. And the bedrooms are ranged behind that. But even though it's only a relatively small house, it's only about, I think, 120 square metres, the architects really maximised the sense of space within it. You know, the ceilings were high and raked. They were panelled with radiata pine, with Oregon beams between. And it was a sense, you know, they did do their best to make that tiny environment as large as possible.
But just standing here, it conjures, it is so evocative of that time. I'm seeing cubes of coon cheese in there somewhere.
And lots of serious brown pots.
Yes, indeed. Mission brown and orange laminate somewhere in that
That's
kitchen.
That's right. Well, Formica was big in there, but it was walnut veneer in the kitchens. Yeah.
I wonder how many of these would have been built around the country.
Well, unfortunately, the records of Pettit and Sevett were lost. However, I think Ken Woolley estimated that overall, from about 1961 through to the enterprise demise in 1978, about 3,500 houses were built. So it's a niche industry if you compare it to the number of houses that were built.
But clearly the build quality is pretty decent. I mean, here we have, you know, these untouched examples here.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're very well built, and they made a special virtue of that in terms of their marketing of the company's product. And they had a van, they had a supervisor that went round in a van, a P&S van, who would check the quality of each house before it was actually opened up to the clients.
Were they more in demand than they could deal with at that time, do you think? What was the sort of public reception like?
Well, 1964 was a big year for them, for Pettit and Sevett. It really marked the beginning of their boom period and the boom period for project housing in New South Wales generally. But for them, they started franchising in 1964. Their first franchise was through Corsa Homes in Perth. But eventually, they were selling across the Tasman in New Zealand as well. So they went almost global. They certainly went national. But
it's interesting, too, when we think of that sort of mid-century modernist moment in this country, we think of the great heroic buildings in the city centres, the galleries of the Australia Squares, and but where that had its greatest impact was in the homes of ordinary people. And it was a tremendously influential moment in residential building.
I think you're absolutely right, Jonathan. And I think architects recognised that. And so many at that point were involved in the project housing industry. Later on, for example, Harry Seidler, Neil Clarahan, Russell Jack also contributed to the Pettit and Sevett range. Architects designed for other project building enterprises, both here and also in Melbourne. You know Merchant Builders, of course, with Graham Gunn, most famously.
What's dropped out of the architectural project, do you think, that is, it feels like a relic of a lost moment? And we still, of course, have architectural involvement in project design now, but it feels a rather different thing to what was going on here.
Yeah, it doesn't seem as distinctive. It's certainly still happening, but I think this was a moment in time that might not be repeated, because I think it's got to do with markets as well. The housing market of the 60s was enormous because people were desperate for new houses. It was a first buyer's market. Finance was accessible. It was a much easier environment. It was a boom period. I mean, there was a credit squeeze in the early 60s, but after that, it was pretty clear sailing until about 1974, when there was another housing downturn.
I can imagine mid-60s, and you say first home buyers, and that's inconceivable today. Yes. In this sort of setting.
Yeah, I know, having access to architect design house. So yeah.
And to space. I mean, here we are, we're sort of 40 minutes from the Sydney CBD, but then this was wild open spaces. So there was land, there was opportunity, and there was clearly young families keen to have that little modernist adventure.
Oh, I think so. And also it became part of popular consciousness, because it was all of these designs, all of the houses that were produced by Pettit and Sevett were shown in all the print media of the day. Australian Home Beautiful did specials on them, Australian House and Garden. There was a lot of interest, and therefore I think it was, you can't repeat that time, really.
Well, and to think of Australian Home Beautiful for its modern equivalent, looking at something of such modesty, really, of, you know, three bedrooms, 1,200 metres, nothing, you know, this is not a McMansion built to the fringes of the block. This is quite simple.
Well, it is. It's a compact geometry, I guess. Certainly the size these days mitigates against their preservation, because, you know, most contemporary home owners are looking to a much larger, or expecting a much larger space within their homes. And so a number of the houses have been demolished over time.
You're listening to Lost and Found, a Blueprint for Living production here on RN. I'm Jonathan Green. We are in search of the Australian modern, a city-by-city exploration beginning right now in Sydney, off to Surrey Hills. I'm about to meet up with Glenn Harper, a senior architect at PTW Sydney.
I am thrilled to be here in front of the Reader's Digest building, Waterloo Street in Surrey Hills. And I had not seen this building before,
right.
And I had no idea what to expect, and I am flummoxed.
Oh, that's good to hear. It's one of these rare gems that have survived. You know, it dates from 1967. Just to put it in perspective, it was completed at the same time as Harry Seidler's Australia Square, and it was completed 1 year before Grounds National Victorian Gallery. Is that what it's called?
National Gallery of Victoria.
Thank you so much for correcting me.
It's quite right. So three very, very different buildings, and yet operating within an interesting aesthetic context.
Certainly is. I mean, you would describe this as modernism, but it's a particular type of modernism. The architect called John James, you would describe him as idiosyncratic, but nonetheless, a passionate designer. Interestingly, studied architecture at Melbourne University. I don't know whether that had any influence, but he finished, in the early 50s, and spent travelling through Africa and Southern Europe for 4 years, working back in the UK. He was back in Sydney, I think the early 60s, set up an architectural practice and acquired this commission from the Reader's Digest, being his largest commission.
And large it is, that it occupies this entire block.
What was here previously was old stables for the Tooth Brewery. So we're in Surrey Hills, and Surrey Hills is quite an old suburb of terrace houses and large format industrial buildings. And Surrey Hills was dominated for many years by a very large brewery called Tooth's.
Let's wander up the hill here, because for this building to appear in the late 1960s, that must have taken people's breath away. Just describe what we're seeing here in this facade.
In some ways, it's a very large Italian palazzo style. It occupies a full block, so it's like a donut in plan. And in the centre of the building is a courtyard. But the courtyard's not at the street level, it's on the roof. The other interesting thing is a lot of buildings at this time were not only done as speculative developments. This is particular to the requirements of the Reader's Digest. And he describes this as the Reader's Digest as designing a home for the office workers. He designed them for about 500 people. Imagine 500 people coming and going through this front door.
And imagine 500 people being employed by Reader's Digest.
Oh yes, things have changed a lot since then.
It is clearly a beautifully built building.
Yeah, very well built, yeah. The other interesting thing that John James was inspired by was the idea of the Fibonacci series of numbers. It's, 1, 3, 5, 8, 13.
Think of seashells and the interior of plants.
Something like that. So the plan has 8 bays,
in the short dimension and 13 bays in the long dimension. So there's your first reference to the Fibonacci series.
It's your golden ratio.
It certainly is, yeah. So it's almost like a golden rectangle in plan.
Wow. Were there any particular challenges in construction?
The formwork, I think, is one of the biggest challenges that he had. But I think that was overcome with the builder had their own form carpenters on site doing the formwork. And it was really just the dimensional control of the formwork. The other interesting thing is the bricks. The bricks are not standard bricks. They're, I think, 300 millimetres by 90 millimetres. And they're laid in one-third displacement. So you have a closer look. It's not just standard stretch of bond. It's one-third displacement. So there's all these interesting things going on in the detail.
And that creates an interesting little vertical of those mortar channels and the one-third up that brick face.
It's called perpens. Yeah.
Is that what it's called? I knew there'd be a word for it.
Oh, yeah, there is a definite word, you know, an architectural term called perpens. So it doesn't place the eye... doesn't emphasise the joint by one-third displacement. You know, Utzon used this sort of approach, and there's some buildings in Melbourne at Monash University that lays bricks in this sort of this way. It's not a common detail, though. So we're standing at the front, so we have an entranceway, and just on the upper side of the building, on Waterloo Street, is a terrace, and that's where the cafeteria was for the 500 staff. And on the southern side of the building, on Adelaide Street, there was a studio for artists and advertisements. And that's where you want your natural southern light. You know, it's an even light. And at the upper end of the site, because the site is sloping, we have the entries for the trucks. So where we're standing is a four-storey building, but at the upper end, or the east end of the building, it's one storey.
Let's have a look inside.
Yes.
Oh, here we get a sense of the height in this interior.
Well, certainly a sense of drama and very low level of lighting. And in the centre of the foyer, sitting in a pool of water, no water anymore, is a staircase that rises four stories. Dimly lit, so you ascend through the building to the various departments of the building. And right in the back wall of the foyer was a very large window, which gave you an opportunity to look into where the computer was. So this is a building that had a very large computer in the 1960s.
And making a feature of that technology.
Well, certainly was, yeah. Not hiding it, but celebrating the idea of technology.
The use of wood is beautiful. That door, and here we see the balustrades or the stairway here.
It is a humanist idea, you know, a Scandinavian idea that those elements that you touch by the hand is timber. So the door, the handrails to the staircase, the doors to the lift are all in timber. And in some of the office areas and corridors, the ceiling linings were battened timber, just to give a bit more a sense of sympathy to the users.
And the concrete here has been poured into timber, and we still have the grain there around that stairwell.
We call that off-form concrete.
See, there'll be another word for that.
Yeah. Off-form concrete with board marking. So there's a mixture of smooth finish as well as board marking, and the board marking correlates to the balustrading of the staircase and the soffit of the staircase that sits in the centre of the foyer.
You would love coming to work here.
Oh yeah, I'd love it to have lunch in the cafeteria, to go up and down the staircase, you know.
To enter this is to, get a sense of the beginning of an entire universe. We've come in off the street. We are in another world now.
It's modern, but it's a sense of giving symbolic expression to uses and various components of the building in a delightful way.
You've been listening to Lost and Found, a Blueprint for Living production. This week, our search for the Australian Modern in Sydney. You heard from Hannah Louie and Philip Goad, authors of Australian Modern, Architecture, Landscaping and Design, 1925 to 1975. Glenn Harper, Senior Architect at PTW Sydney. Judith O'Callaghan, Architectural Historian, Senior Lecturer at the University of New South Wales. Producers are Lisa DeVizzi and Rosa Allen. Technical production by Chrissy Miltiadu. Next week, we're off to Adelaide. I'm Jonathan Green.